This week's show with Hani Newton is sponsored by the Embroiderers Guild of America at egausa.org. You're encouraged to join the EGA through a local chapter, as a member at large, or by joining the Cyber Stitchers online chapter. In addition to becoming a member of an organization of almost 9,000 needle artists, your membership provides you with a subscription to Needle Arts, one of the best magazines you'll find from any hobby organization. You also get access to an ongoing collection of top-flight classes from the best designers and teachers in the world, the ability to borrow books from the 2,000-volume collection in the Dorothy Babcock Memorial Library, access to EGA study boxes that will help you advance your skills, and the ability to participate in the annual juried Fiber Forum exhibition. Membership will make you a better stitcher, and you are encouraged, I'll encourage you to join today at egausa.org. And now on to our show with Hani Newton. Welcome back. I'm Gary Parr.
And I'm Beth Ellicott.
And you're listening to Fiber Talk, the twice-weekly podcast for needlework artists. Our artist this week, Hani Newton from Hani Newton Embroidery. Hani, welcome.
Hi. Oh, it's lovely to be here. Thanks for having me.
Oh, thanks for doing this one. Oh, boy, did we have fun researching you.
Yeah.
But there is a problem.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the Goldwork police contacted me to complain that you don't follow the rules, so they're all upset.
Well, I have some questions for them, for the Goldwork police. what do they mean by rules? Like, surely every rule was invented at some point.
Yes. Well, that was the thing when I saw Goldwork, and so then immediately you expect gold thread couched down right next to each other in perfect little lines, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. perfect little curves. And then I look at your work and, whoa, you don't do any of that. It's, it's just captivating work. Did you learn how to do it the quote right way and then just break off? Or have you always just been, hey, this is the way I do it?
So I studied at the Royal School of Needlework. I was there for the third year that the degree program existed. So it was fairly new, but there was still a real emphasis on sort of learning the foundations of a technique, mm-hmm. and then having space to kind of find your own way with it. I think that approach, that balance of like learning from some of the absolute best embroiderers in the UK, and then having really fantastic art teachers, it really sort of, it was really, yeah, really, really foundational to what I do now. I didn't come out kind of fully formed, I don't think, at all. But just allowing for those two things, like that you can love a tradition and then you can honor it by breaking the rules and pushing it forward,
mm-hmm.
Just completely inspired me. And it's very much an ongoing process. I feel like I'm learning and evolving and growing with it all the time, and still figuring out what that looks like, you know, and allowing that to be part of it, really, that it's not like a done deal.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Well, and that's the real power of the Royal School and other institutions like that, is giving you that foundation. For here's how to do it. Here's how the technique, refine your technique, and then you can just say, all right, got it. Now I can go and be creative with that.
Absolutely, yeah, completely. It's such a good, for me, it was such a good jumping off point, you know, to have that foundation.
Yeah.
While I was there, I worked as a day class assistant, working, you know, in the more sort of traditional classes. So I was seeing probably more than than some of the degree students, like the traditional way of things. And yeah, I'll be honest, some of it I loved and found inspiring, and some of it I thought, we can do more than this. Like, these techniques have existed for centuries, and maybe it doesn't have to be so tightly held in these rules all the time. Like, and that's really, it's, taken, as I say, it's an evolving thing, and it's, that was 2013 when I left there.
Yeah.
So it's been sort of quietly simmering and yeah, growing at my own pace since then.
Now, did you learn needlework of some kind as a when you were young, or is this something that you come to later?
So I was taught by my grandma. She's still with us, but she doesn't stitch so much now. But she was the most amazing needlewoman and seamstress, and just like, she could just sort of, it's like she could magic things into existence. And I was always really inspired by her, and learnt from her. But I love the feeling of making things, but I never saw it as something I would pursue until I was sort of early 20s. It was just a, yeah, something in the background that was just a nice pastime. I always thought I'd do something more academic, I suppose. But yeah, it was through her. And also, growing up, my mum especially was very creative. We were allowed to make a mess. She would, like, there was a time in the summer where she would dig holes in the back garden and fill it with water so we could just jump in the mud. Or she'd, like, fill the dining table with shaving foam. She'd enter like empty a whole can of shaving foam, and we could just play. So yeah, I think moments like that were really important as well, that you could sort of break the rules in that way and make a mess. And yeah, I think that was quite special to have that.
Yeah, see, we and Beth and I have talked about this several times. This growing up in an environment where you can just play and just experiment. Wow,
Yes.
that's, I mean, to make a mud pit and let
Right.
you guys go nuts. Wow.
I remember my grandparents visiting and being a bit like, what are they doing?
Making mud pie, playing in the mud, it's good for
Yeah,
you. You.
exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
So then grow, all right, 'cause that's, you say you came to needlework later, but that's really secondary to the fact that you just grew up in a creative environment with the ongoing permission to just try.
Yes, definitely. Definitely. It was a real way of expressing myself and interacting with the world from when I was little, I suppose. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
And see, based on your artwork, you're one of the minority of people who have retained that, haven't let growing up and maturing affect your willingness to just try and play.
That's very interesting that you say that. It's always so interesting, because when I'm making, especially as you're well aware how immersive embroidery is, when you're making, there's moments where, yeah, there is that sort of playfulness and creativity, but there's moments where there's just graft, where there's just determination and graft and seeing something through.
Yeah.
So it's really nice to hear that still comes through. That sort of, yeah, one of my favorite, especially when I'm teaching, one of my favorite things to, for me to ask myself and people to ask themselves is what happens if?
Right.
And yeah, I think that I'm always trying to maintain that. And it is a real balance because, as I say, with embroidery, there's periods where you just have to be like, right, I am sitting here for the next 40 hours. So
Yeah,
it's So it's a juxtaposition, isn't it, really, when something isn't instant and isn't always, the process isn't, what's the word, always
not instantaneous. It's not instant gratification.
Yes.
But it has something, you know, you take your materials and you're playing with them, you're pushing that boundary.
Yes.
You know, I so enjoyable. And you can see that, like when you said you, because you've been teaching workshops and for those, like what you taught at the British Museum or at the Forge Mill, where it looked like children in some of those classes. And I love that because children tend to be creative. And did you find that fed some of your creativity?
Definitely. In different ways, obviously, like it can be so interesting to see how, because I try and teach in a similar way to how I think about art. So I don't teach in a prescriptive way. I try and sort of teach foundations of technique and then ways that people can, sort of find their own way with that, with lots of pointers. And so, yeah, I do see lots of, just every time I see amazing responses and things I never would have thought of, which is really, yeah, really interesting and inspiring. But also the other thing that really, sort of pushes my creativity and pushes my, sort of broadens my horizons of thinking about that is thinking itself about how I teach and what matters to me in teaching and what I'm trying to share with other people, and how I have to sort of grow and adapt in order to let go of some of my own hang-ups, or to find methods of sharing my philosophy, because I think it really is a philosophy of making and, you know, of cold work with people. And that's been really really pushed me to grow over the last few years, definitely, to how I communicate that.
It says somewhere that you tried the academic world and it just didn't fit.
It did not. I when I was 19, I'd had a gap year and I'd been out teaching in Thailand, and then I came back and I studied comparative religion and social anthropology and Manchester University. And to be honest, I chose it for the fancy name and I just thought, oh, that sounds interesting, I like people. I remember just sitting in Manchester, which I don't know if you know the UK that well, but Manchester is notoriously very rainy, and just looking at the rain and thinking, why am I reading about other people's experiences of the world? Like, I want to go out and, you know, learn myself. And and interestingly, I've only just joined the dots kind of in the last year or so, but I'm in the process of looking at getting a diagnosis for ADHD. And now looking back, I can see that, you know, I need something that holds my interest to stay focused. And then I can be incredibly focused on it. And it was only, when I went to art school that, when I discovered embroidery, really, even before art school, that I just was able to find that passion and focus that I never had for academic subjects.
It's interesting. You hear that people later in life get a diagnosis like that, and it just makes all the puzzle pieces come together. For
yes.
Them. Yeah.
It really does. It really does. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, and I'm sure puts you in a position to deal with it, and just having the understanding and puts a better perspective for you.
Totally, yeah, and permission just to do more of what you love and allow those things to be a superpower which I think they are. I more and more see the way I think about art and the way I'm able to obsessively make as a real superpower, and let go of all the stuff that I find challenging.
What ends
Right.
you up at the Royal School? How do you just take a shot at it and see if you can get in?
Yeah, so I dropped out of university, and I've had a couple of gap years doing different things, and I'd found myself in the south of England, working in a community with special needs teenagers, and it was incredibly it was really rewarding but really intense work. So it was voluntary work, and we lived in and sort of in quite a communal way, alongside special needs teenagers. And I can't even remember where the thought came from, but I just started stitching. I just got some cross stitch things, and straight away I wasn't doing a design. I was making my own up immediately.
One of
I
those,
followed the
Beth. One of those.
yeah followed the rules.
I remember I did try one years before that, a natural pattern, and I just got so lost with the counting where things go, and so that was the first and only time. But yeah, I stitched a piece of cross stitch ribbon. It was a meter piece that I got, and I had this plan. I was going to put it on a dress. But at the end, I love the piece so much that it's framed now, and it's my dad has it. But yeah, so I had this piece of cross stitch ribbon, and I just stitched houses on it. I can't remember why, but yeah, anything I could think of. So places I'd been, places I'd lived, places around me, imaginary places, and just took it everywhere with me, wherever I went. I remember sitting in the park, on a bus, and just stitching, and just this, like, yeah, this is it. That sort of, it was, falling in love, really. It was that feeling of when you, same as if you meet someone and you just think, yeah, there's something here. It was that kind of feeling. Yeah, and that was it,
So, all right,
really.
so then, so now, all right, this is it for me. Now I got to find a way to do something with this.
Yeah, well, first of all, it wasn't even that, because I didn't grow up seeing any artists around me. My dad was a primary school teacher, my mum was a nurse, and everyone around us, all the adults around me had sensible jobs. And I'd never really never con ever considered that art could be something I could do. So it just felt like this is part of my identity now. And then I showed what I'd been doing to a friend who had studied art, and she said, this doesn't just have to be a hobby, like, you can study this. And it was just like, oh yeah, of course. Like, the thought hadn't really, maybe it would have come later, but yeah. So and I just searched online and was like, discovered this place I'd never heard of called the Royal School of Needlework, and was just like, yeah, I'm going, I will go there. And there was just no doubt in my mind that I would find a way to get in. And yeah, I'd never studied art before, so I decided to move back home and did relevant qualifications to prepare myself, which was amazing in itself. That process of, like, discovering how empowering making art can be. I'd, it's something that had not really been a part of my life. I'd never It's so strange to think of it now, because I am an artist, and even if I wasn't making money from it, it's just so much part of my identity and my grounding in the world.
Mm-hmm.
But then it just, yeah, that discovery was really quite special. I'm glad I got to experience that, you know, a few years later than school, I think.
Royal School, feel like you found a home, or intimidating at initially, and you had to kind of work your way in?
Yeah, I think because it was the degree program, and the degree program was new, and we were sort of separate from the, you know, I don't know how to say, you know, traditional stitches. It was, I suppose, sort of parts of it were really comfortable because it was quite arty. But then, yeah, the actual stitching side was really exciting and inspiring, but quite intimidating to begin with. You know, the feeling of like being somewhere that has this huge weight of tradition behind it, and how you, yeah. And of course, when you're learning something from amazing teachers, there's going to be an element of like, this is right, this is wrong, when you're first learning something like that, isn't there? So, yeah, I think looking back now, I was never a natural sort of traditional stitcher. I think there was a moment where my interest would sort of wane a bit if I had to do something because I was told to do it. Yeah.
Yeah. So did you, when you got out of the Royal School, did you immediately start to develop a business in some form where you were going to share your art, sell it?
So I had some really kind of tricky years when I first left. So first of all, I left after 2 years and I went to university down in Cornwall in the south of England. And I chose to go there because I wanted, so it was a more general craft course. I wanted to think who I was as a stitcher away from, you know, surrounded by other stitchers.
Yeah.
And start to find my own voice. So yeah, when I left there, to be perfectly honest, I was so ill prepared for life outside of university. I was like in heaven. University was like my absolute sweet spot. And I didn't really pick up many business skills or much sort of, I didn't think how you transition from just making the thing you love to creating like a viable business or being able to eat from it, and what that looks like. And it was a real sort of jolt. For many years afterwards, I balanced it with, you know, working in restaurants or different jobs like that. But quite quickly, I started teaching, especially with Embroiderers Guild groups around the UK. And I tried different things. I had a wild moment where I decided I was going to start a goldwork bow tie business.
Okay, now that's a niche.
Yes, looking back, I literally thought, this is great, no one's doing this.
Yeah, let's with good go. reason.
And I didn't do, you know, any market research, didn't do any marketing. I didn't understand like how anything worked. I just sort of managed to get a really into quite a fancy show in Chelsea in London and rocked up there and yeah, made a few sales, but had no sort of, did not understand. And I say this because I think it's so important to acknowledge it, that there's like this kind of myth I think we still carry of an artist just sort of, if you're good enough, if you're visionary enough, it happens for you.
Yeah.
And I think I had a bit of that myth kind of in my head. But yeah, I'm so glad that happened now, because it was really formative. It was a real jolt. And looking back now, I'm like, of course that didn't work. You didn't even really care about it.
That would be a problem out of the gate. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. I was excited by the concept, but the actual idea of doing that is, yeah.
Yeah, we see that a lot, though, in the you know, the greater hobby world, is people will get good at it, have a unique approach or whatever it is, and then voices start coming to them. You should make a business out of this. You should sell this, and they do. And then yeah, that you get hit right in the face with the business end of things, and and you start losing your time to be creative. And it really, for some it just sucks the fun out of it. Some actually dig in and make success, and others walk away from all of it. Yeah.
I think it's a really important thing to acknowledge, like, because it does change. You know, it's of course changes it when you add that element of, you know, making money from something.
Right.
It's, yeah, I think it's a really important point. And I definitely wasn't prepared for that when I left university.
So they didn't teach business classes at all then for artists?
It was minimal. I remember, so this wasn't at the Royal School, but yeah, I remember when I was in Cornwall, you know, having a kind of pep talk where they said, expect to have a portfolio lifestyle. And I can't really remember much apart from that, but basically meaning like, you'll probably have to work in a restaurant, you'll do some teaching, you'll sell some stuff. Like, you know, there wasn't an awful lot.
So they basically were saying to you, if you're going to be an artist, you're just going to have to live the life of the starving artist, always scrambling for a few dollars and having your portfolio at hand all the time.
Yeah, that was sort of the message, and
that's rather disappointing. Jeez.
Yeah, it is, isn't it? And you know that you, if you're in the right places, you might get picked, sort of thing. That was the sort of message that I took away originally, but I've worked on those thoughts over the last few years and examined, you know, and actually for me, like, yeah, the gold work is incredibly important. The act of stitching is incredibly important. Hopefully we'll talk about that in a bit, but all of this for me is like a vehicle for my own learning and development and challenging my thoughts and growing as a person, you know, the making the art, the making it a business, the, you know, everything.
What is it about gold work? What makes you lock in on gold work as, as your primary art form?
It's so funny, isn't it? When you do something, when you're immersed in something, it's, what is it? So it's the threads themselves. The threads I use are, you know, made by people that I know their names that make the threads specially for me, that are made, some of them on, you know, Victorian thread machines, and that are using techniques and very similar materials that have been used for hundreds of years, you know, since medieval times.
Yeah.
And are a craft in themselves. They're actually an endangered craft, not embroidery, but the threads, the making of the threads is on the UK's heritage craft red list. And there's only two makers left in the UK now. And so the threads themselves, yeah, the threads themselves are a really precious craft. And then I love the fact that I love working. There's something about working with metals that still, a decade on to me, is like a sort of surprising element to embroidery. I love that it sort of challenges a little what embroidery is, and it has a real sculptural quality to it. And the way that it can play with light as well, that you never fully know a piece of metal embroidery. Because if you place it in a different light, it's going to have a slightly different feel to it. Different parts will catch in the light, and it moves and dances, and yeah, and the threads themselves have a really beautiful memory. So I feel a lot, yeah, like I'm using my fingers to talk to the threads, that I can move them and visualize how they're going to lie. And they'll, they have some memory, so they can stay like that. So yeah, it that feels quite sculptural to me, which I love. It's
Yeah.
really tactile.
Well, and that's what anybody who looks at your work, for me, there were two general things. One is your use of gold thread as lines and lines that are not right next to each other in parallel. But then there's also that sculptural gold work that you do, where you just take these big clumps of things and couch them down and bring such dimension to it. It's just so different from what we normally see.
I love the fact that you can do that with these threads, and I was lucky enough to do a really big commission a couple of years ago, that yeah, sort of felt like it gave me permission to really push the scale. The piece was for an interior designer, and it was like 2.5 meters long, which, for gold work, for embroidery, is huge, isn't it?
Yes.
So I had to think about scale, and I'd used threads in a sculptural way before, but yeah, in order to get the impact on something that big, it was like, right, let's do it. Let's see how big we can go. What happens if?
And then the gold work that is that the light metal that how it's you can how it shines depending on which way the threads lay. I found that intriguing too. It's just beautiful. And all of this is lines, that's just it's just lines of the gold work, but the way you've got them juxtaposed just adds a beautiful texture. I just kept going back to that page and looking at it again and looking at it again.
Oh, that's really nice to hear. Yeah, this is it. I mean, I think one thing that's really important in my work is sort of owning the fact that a thread at the end of the day is a line, and rather than it always becoming something else. I mean, like the big commission I was just talking about, which was a forest. Sometimes it does take on a form, but I love the idea that a line is being itself, if that makes sense. There's like a truthfulness to that, rather than trying always to depict something. And then, yeah, being able to use that line, use that thread to explore what different moods you can get, and how lines can interact. And I think there's endless subject matter there, and it just feels quite truthful to the thread, I think, which I like.
That forest embroidery commission, that one, yeah, I have to. I watched that video a couple of times because it really, to me, it really just illustrated the your art and your what the freedom, I guess, that you're able to apply to couching threads. Talk about that commission, because that thing is, you're right, it is one massive piece. That slate frame you had it on, I assume that was your dad in the video, just helping you, because that thing is huge. Wow.
It's absolutely huge. Yeah. So it was one, yeah, it was a really special project. It was a couple of days before full lockdown was announced in the UK. It got confirmed that it was going ahead. So that was, you know, the world had stopped and I was able to just immerse myself in this project in this most incredible way. And yeah, the brief, so I was working with a really amazing interior designer who, she just really had obviously taken the time to really understand my work and my process and came up with a brief that was so thoughtful to that it was just like, you know, just so easy to work at it. So we were inspired by a painter called Richard Cartwright, who does amazing, really atmospheric paintings of trees. And together we picked a forest, a section of a painting of a forest. And then I had a sort of vague outline, but she just said to me, just do your thing. And then I had just complete freedom to think, right, how can this be a love letter to my craft, to metal threads and what they can do and what can they do? Like, how can I push what I've done before and really use it? My main technique is couching. I'm sure your listeners are familiar with it, but essentially it's just beautifully, beautifully simple. You're just holding one usually thicker thread, like a metal, down onto the surface with a much finer thread over the top. And that is the foundation of couching. And I love that simplicity. Just using that one thread then allows me to question and delve and push. And I think it's the way my brain is wired. Like I can think clearer when I have that boundary, that sort of limitation of this one thing. And then, within that, I can then think, what threads do I use? What thickness are the threads? How are they placed? What's the quality of the line? And just from that, there is just a world, absolute world of possibilities. Within that piece, I've got sections of tree trunks that are couched using up to 60 threads at a time. There were seven trees, and each one I came up with what I called a frond personality. So each one had its own unique way that the threads would swirl or wiggle or tangle. It was really a real love letter to couching, I suppose.
Did you were tearing paper off at one point? Did you make a like a giant Xerox copy of an illustration or something and lay that on the ground cloth?
Yes.
And then...
yeah. The I absolutely loved the problem solving at the start of the project. I loved it. So yeah, this designer came to me and I'd done nothing like it before. Nothing at all. Like the biggest piece I'd made was like, I don't know, maybe 70 centimeters or something.
Mm-hmm.
I always have a thing with big, exciting things where I say yes, and then I figure out how on earth I will do it afterwards. And this was definitely one of those occasions. So, each section of like planning it was like from scratch, kind of, right, how on earth do we do this? How do I transfer a design this big onto? So I tried different kinds of tissue paper, different kinds of things, and then got friendly with a local printer, and he suggested architect's paper, which is like a really sturdy tracing paper that you can print onto, and it was amazing. So yeah, we were able to photocopy, you know, this this to scale design onto print straight onto this thick paper rather than trying to sketch it out, which would have been an absolute nightmare. And then yeah, just rip it away. It's like unwrapping a Christmas present. It's great.
Yeah, it's well, we'll have a link for the video because it's a video to watch. And then just in the pictures and things, you don't strike me as a rather tall person. So you must have had to work all the way around that, work upside down, sideways, all manner of things to get that to go together.
Yeah, well, this was another part of the problem solving that I absolutely loved, was working out how you upscale a frame like that, because I worked out that I could only work in 25 centimeter increments so that my little arms could reach the center all the time. So I designed my own frame, and then a friend of mine who is a brilliant woodworker, for the price of a good Sunday lunch, I got him to make me a frame. I think he made it from part of an old shelf or something. And yeah, it's absolutely amazing. So it's got like a roll. The fabric is on a roll at the bottom and it fits into notches. So I would work 25 centimeters, then unroll it, then move it down a notch, then stitch the next 25 centimeters, which worked brilliantly. I've just finished another commission, and I've used it again. And yeah, it would be impossible without something like that.
So that was a lunch well spent.
Yes! It really was.
It's good to have friends that are handy like that too.
Definitely. Nice. Yes, definitely. That's it. It's a team effort, isn't it? When you're doing these things, and when you're sort of building something yourself, building a business yourself in any way, or, you know, without support of, you know, family as well, I would never be able to do things. It's very valuable.
Yeah. Now, are you still working in the building on your parents' property?
Yeah. On my dad's, next to my dad's house. So yeah, I moved here just before lockdown, kind of with the forest embroidery in mind. And we're actually on the England and Wales border. There's a river that runs through our garden, which is the border. And I've got this very idyllic little, kind of like a summer house, I suppose, like a little outhouse, with two rooms in that I use as my studio, which is, yeah, I'm very lucky to work in there. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. No,
it's great.
It's a brilliant space.
Yeah.
Yeah. Before, it's a big contrast, because before that I was in an artist cooperative. There were 15 of us sharing an empty supermarket. And it was, colourful, let's say, and also freezing. we weren't allowed any heating.
Oh my.
So I took to wearing dungarees with two hot water bottles in the winter to work in.
Oh.
So this is a massive upgrade.
Oh, jeez.
That was terrible. Because sometimes even home, you know, I let my house get a little cool and I'm like, okay, the heat's got to go on. My hands are freezing.
Yeah.
You know, terrible. Terrible.
Character forming, definitely.
Oh, okay. Yes, yes. Character forming. Is that what your dad told you?
Yeah, you can use that label if you want, but it just doesn't sound very pleasant to me.
Yeah, no, I think it definitely like fits into the starving artist mentality, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Which does not serve anyone.
No. Now, Beth mentioned earlier about your workshops. And workshops are one thing, but the environment where you do these things or have done them is amazing. Like Beth mentioned the British Museum, but then I learned something, the Scour Forge Needle Museum.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
And then I had to go look that up. Because and it said at the time, 90% of the world's needles came from that factory. Wow.
Yeah, in Victorian times, yeah. Yeah, the town of Redditch in the Midlands in England was essentially was the centre of the needle-making industry kind of in Victorian times. I don't know if you've heard of John James Needles.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah, they're from there.
Oh.
Yeah, they're originally from Redditch, yeah. So they've got this amazing heritage. You know, everybody there has relatives who made needles for a living. I ran a fantastic project there a couple of years ago where we responded to the collection in the museum, and then I got to make some artworks for them as well.
What fun to do a workshop in an environment like that. Wow.
Yes. Yeah, it was fantastic experience. Yeah.
And the British Museum, that it looked like you were taking it from the, because I went there before lockdown. My family had a trip to London, and that was the place we all wanted to go. It's the British Museum, and I area, the courtyard with those. I mean, I have so many pictures on my camera because see was the textures and then to see what you did with the gold work. I was like, oh, I got to go back and look through my pictures again.
Yeah, it's an amazing space, the Great Court, isn't it? It's it's quite spectacular. I was asked to run drop-in workshops, which was something brand new to me. But I love the idea of like pushing how you teach embroidery, like where you teach it, who you're teaching it to. And in a space like that, where the general public are walking past, you get to do all of those things. You know, some people could sit for 5 minutes, some people could sit for 3 hours. You're having people from all over the world, you know, all genders, all nationalities. It was, you know, all levels of stitch experience. Remember a Japanese businessman hugging me after he'd learned embroidery for the first time, which is brilliant.
So did you supply, did the museum supply the tools you needed and you just passed them out as people came? I gave them a little kit and said, here.
No, I organized it all myself. I was given a brief and again, like the Forest Commission, I love that problem solving element to it, that you think this is so ridiculous. Like, how on earth do I run a workshop for 50 people at a time to just drift in and out?
Right.
Like, right, let's do it. Let's discover how you do that. And yeah, so I created small, and I was responding to an amazing exhibition of ancient Scythian artifacts. The Scythians were nomads in Siberia 2,500 years ago. And yeah, I was responding to that exhibition. So I designed some motifs. I'd never done any lino printing before, but I kind of got the hang of it and printed my own kind of contemporary spin inspired by Scythian artwork, which is really beautiful. If you haven't had a look, it's really quite stunning. There's loads of movement and swirling kind of flowing feel to the pieces. And then they acted kind of like little colouring book pages, I suppose, that people could sit down, pick one up. I was sponsored by one of the goldwork companies, Benton and Johnson, and they provided me with this absolute treasure trove of goodies. So we just had gold strewn all over the tables, and then I organized a team of great textile students from a uni in London came to help. And there was lots of instructions, and then with that many people, you get people who know what they're doing, teaching people who've sat down next to them who've not done it before, and it becomes its own sort of organism that just works. Yeah, it was amazing. And just to it was really exciting to question, like, you know, this craft, which is seen as something incredibly specialized. I think people think it's quite difficult as well a lot of the time. And it's seen as very precious and reserved for nobility, and to see it in this environment where people can like come from the office and sit down with a beer from the bar on a Friday night and stitch in the centre of London was really quite thrilling, actually.
So this
Yeah.
museum is right in London then. Okay.
Yeah. So it's the British Museum, and it's right in the heart of London. Yeah, and I think it's the most visited museum in the UK.
It has a Rosetta Stone, Gary.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's
If you ever get back to London, you need to go
you
there.
need to go. It's an iconic place. So yeah, it was quite surreal, really, to get to do that. It was amazing.
Well, I've been to
Yeah, and that's a
London twice for business trips, and the more we talk to designers and artists from the UK, the more I realize I never got a fair chance to even enjoy London, or I completely missed out. It's just, business
You'll
trips are
have to
just,
start a list then.
Well, I have a list. I have a list. Yeah. Well, I follow a
Excellent.
cyclist. She does long distance, like, multiple hour bike riding, and she lives in Manchester. So when you mentioned about the rain, yeah, it's pretty rare that she'll do a video that the roads aren't wet or it's raining or whatever. It's like,
Yeah,
yeah, you
that
guys
sounds
know
cool.
rain, yeah.
We do, yes.
Yeah, and these kinds of workshops, what's sitting in my head as you're describing them is, we talk about the pandemic and how it has accelerated use of online education and made it more approachable and so on and so forth. But these kinds of workshops, you can just tell you could never replicate that online, that to be in that kind of an environment with people and the history. That's adds so many more dimensions to a stitching workshop.
It's yeah, I'm in the process of thinking about how I want to teach online next year, actually, because I think there are loads of really amazing things about online. You know, I've been able to reach so many more people and meet amazing people from all over the world and bring people together in that way. But yes, it definitely requires very special thought about how you create connection, doesn't it?
Yes.
It doesn't just naturally happen. So yeah, I'm wanting to find, I've got, I'm plotting ways that there can be sessions where it's not necessarily about teaching, but it's about problem solving together and sharing and connecting and time to chat. And because otherwise it can feel a bit like a lecture, and I come away thinking we'll connect to
right,
anything.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, so true. Yeah.
And it is nice that you are offering online, because it does make it the world smaller. So we can, you know, to go to the UK again isn't going to happen anytime soon. But to able to go online and to take a class, and because gold work does intimidate me. I've done it a couple of times, and I my kids always tease me that they're going to buy me another gold work kit, because I just didn't like it so much. It was just like, I try everything. I'm one of those people, you know, oh yeah, that I'll try that. And, but looking at what you're doing, I'm like, oh, wait a second. Because you're not just stitching it in neat little rows where everything has to be exactly perfect. You're taking it and making it much more organic, and I love shiny. So I always get to the gold because it's shiny. It's beautiful. It has a beautiful sparkle. And I'm thinking, okay, now I see what Hanny's doing is something maybe I could jump off with some of my own work and kind of push that boundary a little. It's kind of like you're giving permission. You're like, okay, you know, you don't have to stick in this little constraint. And even your lines, you know, those line projects I find them moving and mesmerizing. And I know that it's just lines, but no, there's something, they say something when you look at them. They speak to me.
Wow, that's so lovely to hear.
When I was studying your work, that was one of the things that went through my head, Beth, was this is gold work Beth would like. I could see you connect with it. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. I guess it's a lot of it is about stripping back the shoulds and sort of figuring out what interests me and then allowing that to take center stage. Is what I encourage people to do as well in classes is, you know, they're really exciting. Like you say, they're shiny and they're really exciting materials, and they have so much potential to them. And I love what you were saying about, you know, how, you know, lines can become more than that. And I don't know if you're familiar with Agnes Martin, the painter.
No.
Yeah, so I'm really inspired by her. And if you look at her work, you will see, like, she takes it to another level, the idea of a line becoming emotion, I suppose. And I've spent a lot of time kind of thinking about what touches me so much about her work, and it's really lovely to hear you say your reaction to my work, because that's how I feel when I see hers. Mm. Yeah, that it's, how can a line like become more than more than itself and make me feel something.
You mentioned you're working on a commission. Is that you must enjoy doing them, or you wouldn't take them on. Add a nice extra challenge to your needlework when you have a commission. And
I really love it. I mean, it's a little challenging to balance something, you know, that takes hundreds of hours with, you know, kind of running all the other parts of a business and still resting and thinking about other things. But It's the challenge of it and the problem solving of it again and pushing me out of my comfort zone. I feel like all that feeds back into my own work and broadens my perspective really on what's possible. And it's so interesting when you work with designers and, you know, other people, and you get a glimpse into how they see your work and what matters to them in art. And then it kind of really pushes my own knowledge, I suppose, in a way that just working on my own stuff wouldn't. So yeah, I love the balance of it, but it is a balance. It is yeah, I sent this project off to America actually last week, and there's definitely then a process of like recalibrating and getting ready to like, oh, what else do I do? Oh yeah, let me remember all those other things. Yeah.
Yeah, those but projects, yeah, they have to be all consuming, I would think, at some point.
Yes. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. The forest is the most extreme example. So that was over 600 hours. And it's a really, it sounds a bit cheesy, but it's almost like a transformative experience. Like what you have to, like sort of the mindset you have to get into to be able to sit and stitch on one piece of fabric for that long. It's like, I suppose what I imagine like an endurance sport must be like, in a way, that you have to have the right mindset and you have to be healthy and you have to sort of be very in the moment. If you were thinking, oh my God, I've got 500 hours left.
Right. No, then you're quitting. Then you're quitting. Because I've run marathons, and you get, if you start thinking, oh, I've got another 6 miles to go, I'm never going to make it. Once you start thinking that, then you got to call someone to come pick you up, you know?
Totally. You have to, do you like have to just think about each step in that moment?
I'm going to get through this step. I just need to get to that next quarter mile. They're going to have gummy bears there, so I'm excited.
Yes. Yes. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Right. Whatever it takes to get you there. But doing that many hours on a stitching project, sitting still and saying, okay, I've got to keep working. I'm moving, making progress. Do you take photos as you go so that you can see your progress?
I do. Yeah, I do a bit. But I feel like I have to be I get in such a specific state of mind that I'm just very much in the moment. For 600 hours. And
yeah, that's quite a moment. Yeah.
Yeah, it's quite a long moment. But yeah, I try and remember, and I have to sort of get in the habit of it. And it is amazing when you see that progress. But while I'm doing it, I just need to be doing it sometimes and not like stepping outside myself and analyzing it too much, because it is a completely bonkers thing to do. I think you need to not think about it too much and just think of
yes.
Honey, this has been an absolute treat. Thanks for making the time for us and sharing all of your art, and so anxious for people to have a look at the photos and the videos that really show off what you do. It's special stuff. Thank you.
Oh, absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
All right, and thanks everyone for listening.